Today is Friday, June 4th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, UN warns of increasing Taliban attacks in Afghanistan.
They've ramped up attacks in some areas against Afghan government forces, that they've strengthened their grip on parts of the country.
Plus, EU threatens more sanctions on Myanmar military.
There is a third row of sanctions in preparation that will be approved on the coming days.
Also, sports enthusiasts mark World Bicycle Day. Our top story today is in the U.S. In a new United Nations report, the global organization warns that Taliban is increasing its military posture in Afghanistan. This study comes as the United States continues to draw down from the country and conclude nearly two decades of conflict. International Edition Steve Miller spoke with VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon about what the report indicated and what may manifest in the months to come.
The UN report, based on the intelligence from member states, basically affirms a lot of what we've been hearing from U.S. intelligence and other agencies in the last couple of months about what's going on with the Taliban, and that is that they've ramped up attacks in some areas against Afghan government forces, that they've strengthened their grip on parts of the country, for example, in northern Afghanistan, where they've really clamped down and control many of the roadways and travel ways there to the extent that they haven't since, according to the UN report, since 2001, and that they've positioned their fighters in ways around district centers, provincial capitals across the country that they at worst have leverage. And in some scenarios, if they feel they're not getting what they want at the negotiating table, that they can use military force and take it. The assessment from the UN basically boils down to, according to the report, that the Taliban believes that it can achieve almost all of its objectives by negotiation or, if by necessary, by force, according to the report.
Does the report indicate where things may be headed for in the future?
The report from the UN, which again is based on the intelligence from UN member states, suggests that the Taliban are at least willing to give it a try at the negotiating table. But there are questions as to how committed the Taliban are and Taliban leadership is towards negotiations, towards a peaceful resolution of decades of conflict in Afghanistan. The report says that it's unclear what the Taliban leader thinks of all of this, and it notes that two of his top deputies, including one who's had control over the Haqqani network, which is kind of an army within an army for the Taliban, if you will, oppose peace talks and favor settling this by military force. And they've got the numbers to potentially do that. The intelligence agencies estimate that the Taliban have anywhere from 58,000 to 100,000 fighters. That's a number that's remained pretty consistent. There's been some attrition, but the Taliban have also been taking some of their forces and placing them in reserve and not having them in active situations across the country. And they can bring pretty big force there. They also have units that are highly skilled when it comes to complex attacks or building IEDs, improvised explosive devices, or rockets. And again, there's a concern that the Afghan government forces are simply not going to be able to withstand Taliban attacks without the support of U.S. advisors on the ground and without the easy access to air support from the U.S. and the coalition in the form of airstrikes. And already the situation on the ground seems to favor the Taliban. According to UN intelligence that's, again, gleaned from members, the Taliban control about 57% of district administrative centers. And when you take a step back and you look at the countryside, Taliban, according to the report, contests or controls anywhere from 50 to 70% of territory outside urban centers. So there's a strong grip there. And it really seems to suggest, based on the intelligence from what the report is saying and from what other intelligence agencies, including the DIA, are saying, that if the Taliban choose, they can use force and achieve probably most of their aims.
That's Jeff Seldon, VOA's national security correspondent, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. China is urging closer security and economic cooperation with Afghanistan in an apparent effort to bolster its influence in the region as the U.S. and its allies prepare to withdraw their forces from the country. The official Xinhua news agency reported that foreign ministers from China, Afghanistan, and Pakistan met via video conference on Thursday and agreed that the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan should be carried out in a responsible and orderly manner to prevent the deterioration of the security situation in Afghanistan and the return of terrorist forces. It quoted Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi as saying the three countries needed to strengthen communication and cooperation for the sake of Afghanistan's interests and those of neighboring countries. The White House has announced it will deliver the bulk of its first 25 million donated doses of COVID-19 vaccine through COVAX, the United Nations-backed program delivering vaccines to low- and middle-income countries. It's part of a down payment on a pledge to donate 80 million doses by the end of June. The Biden administration has been under pressure to share its vaccine supply. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Three-quarters of the first 25 million vaccine doses that the United States is donating will go through the United Nations COVAX program.
5% of these vaccines through COVAX. This will maximize the number of vaccines available equitably for all countries and will facilitate sharing with those most at risk.
Another 6 million doses will go to individual countries, including neighbors, allies, and countries with surges or other crises. The United States has pledged to donate 80 million doses in all by the end of June.
By the end of June. This is 5 times the number of doses any other country has committed to sharing. And these 80 million doses represent 13% of the total vaccines produced by the United States by the end of this month.
But while 80 million doses will help, experts say the world is billions of doses short of what it will take to control the pandemic.
So 25 million doses, yes, a step in the right direction, but really a drop in the bucket to what the global need is.
While more than half the U.S. population is vaccinated, access to COVID-19 vaccines has been wildly unequal worldwide.
Zones. But of the 1.8 billion vaccines administered globally, just 0.4% have been administered in low-income countries. This is ethically, epidemiologically, and economically unacceptable.
Experts say wealthier countries need to step up their donations, plus help build manufacturing capacity around the world. That will take time. One bright spot is that there are still new vaccines in development that may help fulfill the world's needs, Moss says.
We'll be able to improve access. We won't just be working with the current kind of portfolio of vaccines. We'll have new vaccines come along, and hopefully they'll be as safe and effective as our current ones.
The WHO this week authorized the vaccine from Sinovac, which is already in use in Brazil, Indonesia, and elsewhere. That clears the way for uptake in more countries. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Authorities in Australia's Victoria state said on Friday they had detected the highly infectious Delta COVID-19 virus variant for the first time in the latest outbreak in Melbourne, stoking concerns of a major spike in cases. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
Australian authorities said Friday they've detected the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 in Melbourne. It's sparking concerns of an incoming spike in cases. The Delta variant, which likely caused the outbreak in India, is one of 4 more contagious variants classified by the World Health Organization. It was detected in 2 family members who traveled from Victoria State to neighboring New South Wales 2 weeks ago while likely infectious and visited several popular tourist locations there. Victoria's chief health officer, Brett Sutton, said Friday it was possible the two had contracted the virus in New South Wales, but more tests would be needed.
It's obviously a concern that it's not linked to other cases, but we are absolutely, as we've done for the Melbourne cluster, chasing down all of those primary close contacts for this family and looking into where it might have been acquired.
New South Wales has not reported any local cases in a month. Meanwhile, Victoria, Australia's second most populous state after New South Wales, is battling to contain its latest outbreak after more than 3 months of new cases. The government has linked all the cases to a single traveler released from quarantine after testing negative. Melbourne is in its second week of hard lockdown, which authorities have blamed on the spread of the Kappa variant, also first detected in India. Snap lockdowns, regional border restrictions, and strict social distancing rules have helped Australia contain prior COVID-19 outbreaks.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. The European Union will impose a new round of sanctions on Myanmar's military junta and its economic interests in the coming days,
EU Foreign Affairs Chief Josep Borrell told Reuters on Thursday. In an interview in Jakarta after meeting with Southeast Asian diplomats, Borrell said the fresh sanctions from EU will be the third batch introduced since the military ousted Myanmar's democratically elected government on February 1st. Since the coup, EU sanctions have frozen assets or applied travel bans on 21 military and civilian members of Myanmar's junta. European citizens and companies are also forbidden from making funds available to those sanctioned.
We have been sanctioning and we will continue sanction. There is a third row of sanctions in preparation that will be approved on the coming days to personnel from the military junta and also entities that represent the economic interests of the military, which are very important in Myanmar. I had a meeting with the permanent representative of ASEAN countries today. Myanmar was there sitting, and I told clearly what the European Union has always been saying, that the release of political prisoners to end with the repression and to go back to the normal political behavior through free and fair elections is an upmost.
That's EU Foreign Affairs Chief Josep Borrell. For the first time in 12 years, Israel will likely have a new government that does not include Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Pending approval by the Knesset, the new government coalition also includes an Arab party for the first time. Linda Grandstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
After four inconclusive elections over the past 2 years, Israel is on the verge of having a new government that will bring together the right, left, and center. Announcing the new government of change, centrist politician Yair Lapid told Israel's president he had cobbled together a coalition of 61 seats in the Israeli parliament.
Mr. President, I am calling you to say that I have succeeded in forming a government. All of them together, they signed for me. They all signed for me. They all told me I have succeeded as far as they are concerned.
The new government still needs to be approved by the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, later this month. But Lapid will not be the new prime minister, at least at first. To cement a coalition, he had to offer the job first to Naftali Bennett, the head of a small, hardline right-wing party called Yamina, with only 7 out of 120 Knesset seats. Most Israelis just want a functioning government and calm, say analysts.
The Israeli center, right, and left are going to be cooperating and coordinating for the foreseeable future. At a time when Israelis really need to unite, at a time following a war in Gaza, following an international pandemic, they're going to try to bring Israel back together after a period of divisiveness.
Many Israelis considered Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, a divisive figure in Israeli politics for much of his 12-year run. He is currently on trial in 3 corruption cases, a major factor in the drive to unseat him.
Netanyahu demonized the Israeli left, ruled over the Israeli right without letting any alternative really challenge him within his political bloc. And when he will be on the sidelines, it'll be easier to govern and focus more on issues helping the people and less on issues that were helping himself.
The new government has pledged to focus on issues like the economy and healing the split between Arab and Jewish citizens of Israel. Coexistence frayed after violent clashes during the recent Gaza fighting. The coalition will include an Arab party for the first time in Israel's history. However, Palestinians say they don't see much difference between the old Netanyahu government and the new one.
Palestinian blood will be a target for this government, which is no different than the other extremist right-wing governments, which escalate crimes against the Palestinians.
But Israelis say they hope the new government will bring the country together and that there won't be another election for years to come. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
In Ethiopia's Tigray region, millions of people are in desperate need of food aid. And even in Mekelle, the regional capital, displaced families say that in some days, They have nothing to eat. A VOA Heather Murdoch reports from Mekelle, hunger is only one element of the growing crisis stemming from the conflict in the region.
This school campus is now one of more than two dozen camps for displaced families in Mekelle, the capital of Ethiopia's Tigray region. More than 80 people sleep inside each of these classrooms, the families say, and every one has a harrowing story about how they got here.
I was at the market on a Saturday when suddenly tanks pulled in and the war began. I ran to my house and my sister was making coffee. I told her we had to run. We saw houses burning and heard bombs.
The World Food Program says 5.2 million people in Tigray, more than 90% of the region's population, need emergency food aid. But here in Mekelle, where aid is available, people go hungry. By mid-afternoon in this camp, many families say they haven't eaten anything yet and that this is not unusual. Local leaders of the displaced families say residents here are short of almost everything.
We are facing a lot of difficulties. We don't have enough food, shelter, sleeping materials, and clothing. Before the war, we fed our children three times a day, but now we cannot.
The conflict in the Tigray region began in November last year, when Ethiopian government troops were sent to the region to crush the forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Now, roughly 2 million people have been forced from their homes. Thousands have been killed. Many more, like Zufan's 11-month-old son, have been injured. Zufan says her son's arm was injured as she fled, and it took her months to reach Mekelle for treatment.
I went to the doctor yesterday. He said, "Where were you?" He needed an operation, but now you are too late.
There are children at the camp without their parents, and parents who lost their children in the chaos, Zufan says. And while her son may never have full use of his arm again, there are so many other mothers whose children are dead. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Mekelle.
This is the Voice of America. Police in Hong Kong have arrested an organizer of the annual candlelight vigil remembering the deadly Tiananmen Square crackdown and warned people not to attend the banned event as authorities mute China's last pro-democracy voices. In past years, tens of thousands of people gathered in Hong Kong to honor those who died when China's military put down student-led pro-democracy protests on June 4, 1989. Gunmen have shot and killed two policemen patrolling a residential area in the capital Islamabad. Thursday night's attack happened in the Shamas Colony neighborhood. Hours later, the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility. The police officials have launched search efforts to arrest the killers. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Bicycling enthusiasts around the globe celebrated World Bicycle Day Thursday, including in Somalia, a Horn of African nation still struggling for stability after years of conflict. Somalia Cycling Federation was just recognized last year, and with poor roads and equipment, it's an uphill battle to prepare for upcoming international competition. Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
The Somali Cycling Federation has just 20 professional bicycles accepted in the International Cyclist Union, the world governing body for sports cycling based in Switzerland that oversees the competition. Poor equipment and closed roads due to security threats from the armed militant group Al-Shabaab, mainly in the capital Mogadishu, are a couple of challenges facing young cyclists training for international competition. The Secretary General of Somali Cycling Federation, Saeed Ahmed Abukar, says, despite the challenges, they are committed to building the sports at grassroots level. He says most roads used by cyclists for training in Mogadishu are either dilapidated or closed for security purposes, and therefore it has become a great challenge to achieve a smooth training schedule. He added they also lack enough equipment such as helmets to protect the riders from injuries during accidents, and instead cyclists use football gear as an option. In April 2018, the United Nations General Assembly declared June 3rd as International World Bicycle Day. One of the up-and-coming Somali cyclists, Hassan Barre Ugas, emerged in the second position during Somalia's cross-country cycling championships held last year. Barre, who practices in the gym most of his time to avoid poor lanes, says his dreams of flying the flag of his country in upcoming regional and international cycling competition. He says he's practicing very hard in the gym and sometimes on the city streets, wishing to represent his nation in upcoming international competition, such as the African Championships and the Olympic Games. According to the United Nations, apart from its sporting activities, the use of bicycles makes education, healthcare, and other social services more accessible to the most vulnerable populations in Africa, and contribute to the cleaner air and less congestion on the roads. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The world's oceans, once viewed as too big to deplete or destroy, are in crisis. There are many reasons for this: climate change, overfishing, illegal fishing, pollution, and other factors. There are also horrific crimes committed against workers on the high seas, much of which are outside the specific legal jurisdiction of any country to police and beyond the political will of many policymakers to correct. The vast intersection of ocean environmentalism, labor, and human rights are the subject of a new book, Outlaw Ocean: Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier, by Ian Ubina. Ubina is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who has spent the last 7 years reporting for the likes of the New York Times, the New Yorker magazine, and the Outlaw Ocean Project, the nonprofit he formed to shed light on the wild and watery frontier most of us will never see or explore. Ubina spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
You know, the two-thirds of the planet that's water is this realm that rarely gets covered journalistically, and it's existentially important to the planet, but also 50 million people work out there. And for all of these reasons, we try to tell stories about human rights, labor, and environmental abuses that are occurring offshore.
That's a lot of so-called ground to cover.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of the space, it's sprawling and hard to police. The high seas in particular are jurisdictionally complicated. It belongs to everyone and no one, so no government really takes responsibility. The nature of the people that work in the space are often migrant, trafficked, undocumented labor from developing nations. For all these reasons, abuses are more common and often occur with impunity, since there's very little investigation or prosecution happening about the crimes out there.
Who are the main victims of those crimes?
The foremost victim of crimes out there is the ocean itself, and the crimes range from intentional dumping to unfettered, unregulated mining. More than 80% of the world's fish stocks are at or beyond the point of collapse. They've been overfished. You also have a rampant problem of illegal fishing. One in five fish that end up on the average person's plate comes off of a pirate vessel. By 2050, some research says there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish. So the state of affairs at sea are pretty bleak.
Then there's the horrific human element. It's just one example in your book. You describe a foot wound on a crew member aboard an illegal Chinese fishing vessel. The guy's foot had been cut by a catfish whisker.
His foot got extremely infected, and when we boarded the vessel to inspect it for other crimes, he kind of came out of the woodwork and showed us his foot. It was so swollen and the skin so tight it looked like a oozing eggplant. We had a doctor come on board and try to dress the wound, but the guy didn't have any footwear to keep that foot dry, and he was just going to go back to work. So that gauze and such would just, you know, soak in the nasty detritus that lines the fish deck anyway.
Was he there of his own free will?
From what I could tell, we're not debt bonded or shanghaied, or they're making woefully low wages. It's pretty shocking, but most of them have a contract of sorts and they're working, you know, 2-3 month rotations and then they go to shore. The living conditions on the boats were just abysmal, but they were not debt bonded as you find, say, on the South China Sea.
That's Ian Ubina, author of Outlaw Ocean: Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips prior to his retirement last month. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Daniel Brown, and our managing editor, Kate Poundoski, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.